pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views, and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business, and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener. We're up to episode 45. It's the 18th of May, 2016, and, you know, we're podcasting to you from the Secular Party campaign headquarters. With me is is the Velvet Glove. How are you, Scott?
I'm very well, thanks, Trevor. How's yourself?
I'm good. People would probably be expecting a hum of activity in the background, people working phones, rushing from photocopiers to printers and stuff like that, but unfortunately, it's a pretty quiet headquarters.
It is very quiet headquarters, that's for sure. We have put in our printing order, though, so yes. As soon as those flyers are printed, then we will be on the hustings, for sure.
We're running on the smell of an oily rag. Mm.
We are, although that said, though, we did get another donation.
Yes.
And her name escapes me.
I think it was Janelle.
Thank you very much, Janelle, yes.
Good on you.
Yeah, much appreciated.
Mm. In other news, Scott, before we move on to the topics, other campaign news... like our website, we're under cyber attack, folks. Like
we're still under cyber attack.
Mm. So there's some nasty group. I suspect a bunch of cardinals in Rome, but you know I could be wrong. But we're getting cyber attacked at our website, and so our IT guru is frantically blocking IP addresses and trying to stop it from happening. But as we speak, Scott, the website's down again.
Website's down again. Bloody hell.
So dear listener, if you're sort of wanting to get onto the website and having difficulties, bear with us while we while we deal with some malicious Russians or whoever they are who are under, you know, who are attacking us. So we must be doing maybe we're doing something right, Scott, if we're finally getting attention.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, we certainly seem to have upset the right people. Anyway,
Mind you, the Iron Fist Velvet Glove website has not come under attack as yet. So, maybe...
no, it hasn't come under attack. That's true.
So anyway, all right. Well, we will launch a few attacks of our own this evening in episode 45, Scott, and where better to start than the budget that was handed down not so long ago. And a really interesting article. Folks, you'll remember that in the budget, a key thing was reducing the tax rate from 30%, eventually down to 25% over the next 10 years for companies, currently smallish companies, but eventually pretty much every company except a handful. And the government said that this was going to, attract more foreign investment, producing a bigger, more productive economy. And they forgot about one thing with that, Scott.
Which is?
Well, which is that under an agreement with the USA, see, the US company tax rate is 35% and ours was 30. And under the agreement, our tax treaty with the Americans, US companies working here, when they repatriate income back to the states, they pay the difference between what they paid here and what they would have paid in the states. So they currently pay 5%. But if we drop our tax rate to 28%, they'll pay 7% to their own government. And if we drop it to 25%, they'll drop 10%. So they won't actually save any money at all, the US companies who are here. That just means more money that they'll pay to their government rather than to ours.
And that is one of the more ridiculous problems with this $50 billion giveaway is that, you know, they've calculated it out. They reckon it's about $11 billion over the next 10 years. It's going to be transferred from our treasury to theirs.
That's right. So with no benefit whatsoever, because these companies will be in exactly the same dollar position at the end of the day. All it means is that we've handed, in this government, Scott, we are just handing $11 billion to the US government for no good reason.
It's $11 billion to the US government on top of the $24 billion that we've already given the US for the Joint Strike Fighter. So we're at $35 billion so far.
At least we got an aeroplane for that, didn't we?
Well, eventually we'll get an aeroplane, yeah, for sure. But
we get nothing for this $11 billion.
No, this $11 billion is going to get us nowhere. It's here in the article. $11 billion lost for no economic benefit, and you know what? It's hard to argue with that. It's impossible to actually say that the $11 billion that's going to be going over there is going to be staying behind here to employ other people. It's just not going to happen.
Mm. Maybe we should work that into our agreement when we buy something from the Americans next time. Is that, you know, if we change our tax rates and you're going to get more money, just accept that as a part payment. You
know? Well, that's always an option, yeah.
So there we go. Scott Morrison, our treasurer, has stuffed that up beautifully and has handed over $11 billion to the US Treasury with zero return for us. So thanks for that, Scott Morrison. Mm. Next up... Scott the Velvet Glove, funding to private schools rose at twice the rate of public schools, according to a new report, which was done by the Australian Education Union. So they went through my school data and drilled down through the figures and crunched some spreadsheets and looked at funding. Mm. And said that between 2009 and 2015, they looked at the increase in funding for schools from all government sources. And public schools increased by 14.6%, but Catholics, their funding increased by 30.2%, and independents by 30.3%. More inequality on the way, Scott.
It certainly appears that way. It's... I don't know what else to say other than it's a stupid bloody thing to do. You know, it's absolutely crazy that you've got private schools getting more than just top-ups. They're getting... You know, they're getting a damn decent chunk of government money to fund their recurrent expenditure.
To fund their rifle ranges and aquatic centres, Scott.
Well, there's...
in some cases.
There's no doubt there's that, for sure. But, you know, it's absolutely maddening that you've got this. It's
people are understanding this, Scott. They really are. So the other thing in this report, it said that... low socioeconomic status students comprise 9% of independent school enrolments, 14% of Catholic schools, and 30% of public school enrolments. And, of course, kids with special needs and disabilities and all that sort of thing are going to be vastly more of them in the public school sector. Just to recap, folks, the Scott Morrison, the budget, allocated $1.2 billion extra for education, but Gonski needs 4.5, and Gonski is what we need because Gonski was saying we need to fund schools based on the clientele that they're servicing, their capacity to pay, and the difficulties that their kids have in learning. So,
and it should be repeated there that it should be dealing with the actual clientele of the school, not the clientele of the surrounding areas of the school. So Geelong Grammar, which is, you know, a very wealthy school, gets a hell of a lot of government funding because the surrounding areas aren't wealthy.
Correct. Ah, right. Because kids come from all over the place and board at Geelong Grammar too.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Because I think fees there's 1 year, I think it's grade 9, where they're basically camping all year. They're out on a special property somewhere. And
is that right?
Mm, the fees are something like $80,000. It's an enormous amount of money. So,
bloody hell.
And people send their kids from all over Australia to do that year at Geelong Grammar. Scott, you know, Gonski is not that difficult to fund. Like, you only need an extra $3.3 billion on top of what the government, you know, supposedly put up as extra for funding.
Yeah, so we've already got $5 billion from the churches.
So, yeah, we've got to find 3.3, and I was doing some back-of-the-envelope calculations before we started, Scott. So we've got to find 3.3. Where could we find it? Well,
we could do without one sub.
Exactly. Each sub is 4.16 just to buy it, Scott. But there are reports that the actual maintenance of these subs will be double that figure each.
Oh, you're joking.
No. It's quite possible that the maintenance of them will be $8 billion each. But let's just work on, you know, Gonski, you know, one sub.
Yeah.
At least. But, yeah. Well, taxing religion, that would give us somewhere, I reckon, between 5 and 10 per year.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Negative gearing, according to Saul Eastlake, and we'll talk about him a bit later, there's $4 to $5 billion a year if we phase that out. The tax cut to companies, that was worth $50 billion over 10 years. It's and the subs we've talked, like, it's not that hard to find 3.3, Scott.
No, it's not that hard to find 3.3 at all. Mm. And you know, when you actually say it out loud there, you know, $50 billion over 10 years, there's a hell of a lot of the deficit that can be paid off with that.
Yes.
You know, that's a, you know, it's crazy that they've given that away.
It is. Okay. Next up, another article, Scott, by Christina Keneally.
Oh, God, it makes you wonder why the hell she still carries around her rosary beads, doesn't it?
She's a very strange Catholic, this lady.
She is, yeah.
So, you know, regular listeners will be aware that in previous episodes we've quoted Christina, and she's incredibly frustrated with the Catholic Church and bemoans what they're
doing. And not without good reason. Yeah. There's good reason for that, yeah.
To her credit, she cites very lucidly her reasons why she's disillusioned, but she continues to be one. And here's another article along the same vein where she talked about... there was talk about the Pope was asked about whether potentially women could become deacons in the Catholic Church, and people were at some conference. He was asked, you know, to study that and to look into it, and he said, "I accept," the Pope said, "blah blah blah. I am in agreement," and of course. You know, the Catholic newsletters that I subscribe to, Scott, all have these articles saying, oh, the Pope's considering, you know, improving the lot of women in the church and potentially making them priests, etc. And Christine Keneally says, that's just not going to happen. Pope Francis is the master of being all things to all people, using off-the-cuff remarks to sound progressive, but changing nothing when it comes to actual church rules. And she said, remember in 2013 about homosexual people, he said, who am I to judge? Yet he's done nothing. And she says, there's zero chance of him making a change, and we're just going to hear the usual feminine genius or the complementarity of the sexes claptrap. Are her words? I hope I'm wrong, she says. 40 years of being a Catholic feminist tell me I'm not going to be.
it was at that point there that when I read that line, where that's when I really thought to myself, bloody hell, you know, you've been in the church for 40 years and it tells you that, you know, this tells you that you're not going to be wrong. It really just stuck with me. I thought to myself, why the hell does she bother?
Strange. All right, we're both moving on. We're both signed up as we get our newsletter from Corey Bernardi, who usually comes through on a Wednesday too. We record Dear Listener on a Wednesday night, so a little bit of Corey sort of comes in when necessary. So. So he made a trip into South Australia's agricultural area called the Riverland, and was talking to farmers and growers who raised three concerns with him of water, labour and electricity. And Scott, the one that interested me was his talk about labour costs. And so this is quoting from Corey. In a significant town with 12.6% unemployment, almost every horticultural job was filled by internationals. When asked why this was the case, one employer told me the following anecdote. After advertising for workers, they might receive 40 applications. When told of the need for a drug test, more than half of the applicants drop out. Of those who do submit to the testing, another half fail the test. Of the eight or so remaining, perhaps four are suitable for the job requirements. After offering them a position, the employer considers themselves lucky if two turn up on the first day.
Well, you know how to solve that, don't you?
Yeah, I've got an idea. I don't think it's...
Yeah.
Well, Corey's solution yeah. is that people on the dole should be drug tested, and if they're on the drugs, they should stop getting welfare.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a recipe for having, your front window kicked in and your stereo and everything else knocked off.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the other solution, the obvious one...
The obvious one is legalise all drugs.
You know, I suspect that most of those would have been marijuana. And so if you decriminalise drugs, and in particular marijuana, then suddenly 30 people who were ineligible for a simple job of picking fruit are now eligible and can actually get some work.
That's exactly right. I mean, like, let's assume that you've got to drug test the guys that are going to be moving heavy equipment.
Hmm.
But of those 40 that applied, barely four of them would be needing to be driving anything at all, and the rest of them would be out there just picking fruit.
You would think so. And, you know, often with these things, like, marijuana stays in the system for a while, so, you know, it can show up that... You know, you had some 3 days ago or something like that, but...
It does stay in the system for quite some time.
Yeah, so there's the solution, Corey. At the end of the day, that's a magnificent argument as to why we should decriminalise drugs, because suddenly 30 ineligible, low-skilled workers can get a job picking fruit in the Riverland area. So I don't think that was the solution Corey was looking for, but it looks like a good solution to us.
Well, Corey wouldn't be agreeing with that because he's... I've heard him before in the Senate. He stands there, you know, defending the war on drugs to the end.
Mm.
Yeah. Yes,
it wouldn't fit his conservative right-wing values.
No, it wouldn't.
Scott, in other news relating to the budget, article from John Menadue's blog about overseas aid and the cuts that have been made to overseas aid by Julie Bishop.
Yeah, it's taken us down to a record low.
Mm. So apparently our aid is down to $3.8 billion, and Julie Bishop has presided over the biggest drop in overseas aid of any foreign minister in our history. So...
Is that right?
Yeah. Yes, under her guidance, the change, based on percentages related to our gross national income, it's effectively dropped 33% under her reign. And the next worst performer, Scott, was Bill Hayden, under who it dropped 17%. And the best ever performer was Stephen Smith from Labor, under who it increased by 16%. So our foreign aid is just plummeting under Julie Bishop. And meanwhile, Scott, we're spending all this money on defence. I think they've got the priorities wrong here. Like, prevention is better than cure, as we know in so many things in life, Scott, you know. Stitching time saves nine, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that rather than spending $50 billion on 12 submarines, oh, we're now spending $48 billion on 11 of them.
We've dropped a sub off.
Sorry?
We're picking subs off.
Yeah, well, okay, we're picking subs off, but maybe we should knock off another sub.
Yes.
And get it down to 10.
Yep.
And then we're going to more than double our foreign aid budget.
We are. So, see, the point is,
And also, you'd only have to spend 10% of your, you know, let's look at it. If we want to double the, well, we'll more than double the aid budget, we'll go to $5 billion above what we've already got there.
Well, it's 3.8, so we've got to spend another 3.8. So
yeah, okay, spend another 3.8, so we can knock off one more sub.
Yeah,
that comes down to 10 subs, right?
But Scott, if we're going to tax religions, we've got 5 to 10 billion. We've only spent 3.3 on
Gonski.
So we could probably fit in the 3.8 just on tax and religion. But if not, a bit of sub work will do the trick.
And then also, if you then you take back of that 50 billion that you're planning on spending over the next 10 years giving tax cuts to our corporations,
yes,
if you kept 10% of that,
yeah,
there's another 5 billion there.
That's right. I mean, there's money everywhere in this budget that to pay for things like this. But Scott, I mean, even if people were very selfish and thought, well, we don't want to help other countries, like, too bad, they can just look after themselves. It's just as a matter of pure self-interest on our part, we should help these countries because, you know, if we don't, we're just going to have a bigger problem down the track for ourselves. So in this John Menadou blog, he says, you know, consider what reductions in aid mean in our regions. In our region, look at Papua New Guinea, which has a population of 7.76 million people. And what would a failed state in Papua New Guinea look like? It's a really good point.
It's a very good point, and it's not something that bears thinking about because it would be a disaster for us.
Yeah.
You know, you think you've got problems with boat people now. If Papua New Guinea becomes a failed state,
yep,
then you're going to have millions on the march, and they'll be marching south.
Exactly. And, gee, you know, 3.8 billion can go a long way to helping stop that happening. And to give an example, he mentions in his blog here the example of the Solomon Islands in 2003. So Australia led a coalition of countries, sent police and armed forces to restore order. Over the next 10 years, until they were withdrawn, we had 7,270 Australian personnel served in the Solomons, and it cost us $2.6 billion. And that was just the Solomon Islands. So
you can imagine what a Papua New Guinea engagement would cost us.
Yeah. So, Scott, I reckon that seeing we're able to save money and raise money in our secular party ideas and taxing religion and the like, you know, doubling the overseas aid budget would be some of the best defence money we could possibly spend.
Well, it also, you know, it's, I know it's a very dated analogy, but, you know, you look back at Vietnam. Now, at the height of the air war there, the United States was spending $21 million a day on the air war.
Mm.
Now, imagine if they'd spent $19 million a day on a foreign aid program in the South and then spent $1 million a day on a propaganda program saying to the North, your leaders have lied to you. Look at how much better things are in the South.
Mm.
You know, they would have achieved more and they would have been left with a country that would be in the, well, in the palm of America's hands to do as they wish.
Yeah. You know? Yep.
Anyway.
So anyway, I think during the course of this campaign, Scott, the Secular Party will be running up an increased a policy on increasing overseas aid and seeing how that flies. So that will...
Well, I think it's going to fly if you can get people to think about it.
Mm.
If you can get people to sit and really think about it, then it's got to make sense.
Mm. So I'm looking forward to announcing something like that. So stay tuned, folks.
Absolutely.
We've mentioned before a little bit about, well, I think I have, about population, overpopulation, and, you know, massive cause of main single reason for human misery and poverty, and also global warming. So two articles on overpopulation, Scott. The first one saying it's the real cause of climate change. It's killing us all off. And this article by Joe Barry in the Irish Independent says the real cause of global warming is rarely mentioned. It is the elephant in the room. Everyone can see it, but no one wants to speak about it, presumably because this subject is a contentious one and challenges the core beliefs of many religions. The undeniable fact is that we, the human race, are the cause of our own difficulties, and unless we reduce our numbers, we will self-destruct. So he makes the case for birth control measures. He says, this was an interesting one, Scott. In 1985, when famine struck, the population of Ethiopia was 36 million. That famine eventually ended, and their current population is now 100 million. In 1960, there were only 11 million. Like, these are really poor countries just producing lots and lots of people. And it's hard to find a place for them.
It's not sustainable. It's not sustainable to produce that number of people in a relatively short period of time.
So it says here, we send money to poor nations to help sink wells and buy livestock, but do little or nothing about helping them control their rate of reproduction, which in turn creates further famines. Assistance and education in introducing birth control would surely provide a more lasting solution. And Scott, when we spend that $3.8 extra billion dollars on overseas aid, a significant sector of that will be on sort of
birth control,
population control measures.
He's put it out beautifully. He said it is the elephant in the room that everyone acknowledges, but no one's prepared to talk about. And it is. He's hit the nail right on the head.
And the other thing about that, of course, is it will really annoy religions. So that's one thing that sort of drives me with that one. Not only is it clearly the best thing to do, but it'll just really, really annoy the religions.
Well, the thing about it is that, you know, you've got the Catholics are saying that, you know, if everyone went on to a vegetarian diet, then you could, I think, double the population on planet Earth.
Who said that?
Who
said that?
The Catholic Church has.
Oh, have they? Right. Okay.
Yeah, they have said that. So, you know, that's a bloody dangerous position to take. But anyway, it really is something that we've got to handle, and we've got to move quickly on it too.
It's the root cause of the problem. You know,
it is, yeah. And you've got that problem. You know, he put it down there in Ethiopia, moving from 11 million people in the 1960s to 100 million now. You know, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a lot. Another article on a similar vein, linked there. It says that the human race adds 1 million people every 4 days. And it says that we're just in denial about climate change, human overpopulation, and the accelerating consequences, and gives some reasons as to why we're in denial. The first being capitalism. We just don't want to give it up. The second being ancient religions brainwashing parishioners. The third is democracies promoting free choice to the point of suicide of the planet. Fourth is that most citizens are just short-sighted. And fifth, most leaders are ignoring the danger. But makes the point about religions, of course, in that one. So yes, Scott, I think, if we have the humble objective of just saving the world, then starting on population measures will be pretty good first step for the secular party.
It'll be a very good first step, for sure.
Another one from John Menadue. Are conservatives better economic managers? And
no, they're not.
Exactly right. And he says that the evidence and the record do not show that. First little minor point, only Labor treasurers, Paul Keating and Wayne Swan, have ever won the prestigious Euromoney Finance Minister of the Year award. But more importantly, Scott, ABS data show that average quarterly GDP growth and average monthly increases in employment are stronger when Labor has been in government compared with coalition. So just remind me again, what's the mantra for the Turnbull government for this election? What's the three-word slogan?
Jobs and growth.
Mm. Apparently, historically, according to ABS data, jobs and growth have always been better historically under Labor governments.
Yeah, that's true. Mm. It is true. We don't really know exactly why it is, but it's clear that it is better.
Mm.
Yeah, for sure.
Most people wouldn't believe that if you told them that.
No, they don't. And you know, it's well, he points it out. You know, that he said that. The first is that Labor has been in office at the wrong time.
Yes.
Coalition governments held office in the long boom years between 49 and 72 and 96 and 2007.
Mm.
Both Robert Menzies and John Howard were very lucky.
Mm.
And they were extremely lucky.
Mm.
Mm.
And he says second reasons is conservatives have successfully persuaded many, including themselves, that government spending is inevitably wasteful and Labor is all about taxes and spending. So they sort of have run that line very successfully. And a third assumption is that rich people are clever and therefore better managers. So that's sort of why, three reasons why people kind of wouldn't have thought that Labor, in fact, has a better record on jobs and growth than the Conservatives do.
Mm.
And in this article, Scott, he also mentioned a really interesting thing during the Whitlam government period. Blah, 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 blah. And it says about the Whitlam government... both sides were at fault. The Whitlam government did, however, set Australia on the path to freer trade with a 25% across-the-board cut in tariffs. It, being the Whitlam government, refused to bow to the Department of Defence and knocked back the Navy's plan for locally designed and built light destroyers. It chose instead to buy off-the-shelf frigates from the US. The Department of Defence went into quite a sulk. There you go. So if we knock back...
we've done it before. We should do it again.
Yeah, if we knock back these subs and get an off-the-shelf nuclear trio of subs, we'll simply be replicating one of the decisions of the Whitlam government. There you go.
Exactly.
So there's a bit of potentially history repeating itself. Mm. What else did he say? Just about the cost of... Actually, he does mention the cost of the subs, I think.
For a government that presumably has some regard for markets and free trade, its decision on a $50 billion submarine and naval build in Adelaide is remarkable.
Hmm.
Christopher Pyne must be really a national treasurer if the government needs to spend so much money to help keeping in public life.
Hmm. He makes the assertion that it's potentially going to cost $4 million for every job created.
Yeah, it's... It's absolutely phenomenal how much money is being spent per job.
It is phenomenal. Yeah. Oh, dear. Okay, so that's John Menadue. Religion will play a role in the 2016 federal election, according to John Werhorst, and in an article, and various things to say. But the bit that, again, interested me was... Dear listener, just the number of Christian groups who are interfering in politics. And he says here, this time the election politics of religion is much more likely to be about issues presented by faith-based pressure groups, church schools and their advocates and other church agencies. There have already been intimations of likely election campaigns, including interventions to release children from offshore detention centres, and that's by the Catholic Religious Australia, opposition to corporate backing of same-sex marriage, that's the Catholic Archdiocese of Sydney, criticism of the treatment of lower-income groups in last week's federal budget from faith-based welfare groups, and advocacy of freedom of speech in the same-sex marriage debate, the Australian Christian Lobby. So you could just rattle off groups with some sort of religious backing who stick their noses into all sorts of political stuff, which is fine, but, you know, they want the separation of church and state. It's all one way in their favour. They can come out and criticise and be involved, yet as soon as somebody wants to ask them to pay some tax, they're not interested.
Yeah, exactly. And it's crazy that they continually stick their head in the sand about the taxation issue.
Mm.
It is something that's going to have to be dealt with, and it should be dealt with sooner rather than later.
Mm. Just annoys me that they're so willing to enter the debates on policy and politics and, you know, tell people how to vote and yet, you know, insist on separation of church and state when it comes to financial matters. Hmm.
Yeah, it is ridiculous. It's crazy that they stick to that one line. Mm. You know?
Well.
Anyway, there is one final warning, if you like.
Mm.
But candidates should always be wary of the intensity that faith-based groups, especially conservative ones, can sometimes generate on the right issue. The best the religious left can hope for is to neutralise conservative campaigns by reminding the candidates that many church people are driven by compassion, not dogma.
Yeah. It might be a bit generous there. The prosperity gospel people, you know, the Scott Morrisons of this world. I don't know that you could say that. The New Age.
That's very true.
Yeah. Scott, you would have heard of Mark Texter.
I have heard of Mark Texter, yes.
Mm. So he's sort of...
I was very interested to read his article too.
Mm.
Well, the article that was quoting him anyway.
Yeah, he's a noted campaign strategist for the Liberal Party. I think he was very influential for... John Howard, was that be right? Was he?
Oh, I believe so,
yeah.
Yes.
And yeah. I think he even ended up in the UK helping out over there at one point.
Mm.
And he's quoted in this article as basically saying that there's a difference between the government and the party, and that there's a bit of a disconnect there, that people get into the Liberal seats who aren't necessarily got liberal policies in mind, and the best part is he's saying that their agendas can be quite different between the party and the politicians. He says here, instead, 21-year-old pimply theorists from the Institute of Public Affairs and the Australia Institute with little real-world experience have been running the show. The policy process is dried up and kaput. There are too many scattered ideologues with agendas, and the process is broken to get politicians in the right place. So I think he might be talking about our friend from
from Victoria. Gone into the Senate?
Yes.
His name escapes me.
Yeah. It'll come to us again. But I think
he's got
him in mind, Scott. Yeah.
I think so too. I mean, he's hit the nail right on the head there when he talks about 21-year-old pimply theorists.
Yes,
but you know, it's crazy that both parties are guilty of this.
Mm.
They have, the ALP tends to put up people who have grown up in the union movement and then have gone from being a union organizer to then being a staffer and that sort of stuff, and then that's how they become. Parliamentarians, but it's absolutely crazy. And the Liberal Party's no better. The Liberal Party is as bad.
James Patterson, that's him.
James Patterson, yeah. That's him, yes.
So basically Texter is having a bit of a whinge that that right-wing nutters like James Patterson from the IPA are getting seats and they're totally disconnected from traditional Liberal policies and values.
And he's dead right. Mm. He really is dead right. Mm. It's crazy that they do that.
Mm. Scott, Saul Eslake, everyone would have heard of him.
Saul Eslake, he's a well-known economist.
Mm.
Yes, and he's now with the Hobart University in Tasmania in Hobart.
I saw him at a financial planning lunch type thing. And,
mm.
You know, sometimes you hear people speak and...
so impressive because he was totally on top of his brief. He knew all the facts and figures. He spouted them with confidence and intelligently. And I just remembered coming away from that thinking, holy smoke, this guy really knows what he's talking about. And every time I've seen him since on the television and that, I've had no reason to think otherwise as well. Like, he's a very smart guy on top of economics in Australia. I think you'll agree.
Ooh.
Mm. So
absolutely, I do. Yeah, he's a very impressive individual.
Mm. So there's a great video which you can watch, and it is on the late line program where Saul Eslake debates with the Institute of Public Affairs, Sinclair Davidson, over negative gearing. And and apparently Saul Eslake has been saying for 30 years that we should be getting rid of negative gearing. And
well, you know, and he's really hard to argue with in that point, because, you know, I had no idea that Australia was one of the very few countries that allowed this to happen. Mm. I just assumed that it was available to everyone.
Mm. Well, no prizes for guessing that that Sinclair Davidson from the IPA, he's in favour of negative gearing, Scott.
Yes.
So in this video, look, I think Saul Eslake totally owns him. This guy is. So, you know, Saul Eslake basically says that it's a significant cost to the budget, which he estimates at somewhere between $4 billion and $5 billion per annum. So that's where I get the figure from, Scott. When I say, let's phase out negative gearing and we're going to get $4 or $5 billion per annum, I reckon, if I can just quote Saul Eslake, that's a pretty good source.
It is a pretty good source, yeah.
He says that it does little in terms of its stated aim of promoting increased investment in rental properties. He says over 90% of geared investors now purchase an established property. Its main impact is simply to put upward pressure on prices. And he's got statistics to show that home ownership in the age group from 25 to 55 is plummeting. And basically sort of leads off with that as his reasons for why we should get rid of negative gearing. And Sinclair Davidson, in response, says it's not a cost to the economy so much as a transfer in time. You either deduct money now or deduct money in the future. So it's nothing to worry about at all, is what he says. And Saul Eslake makes the point later on that it's not about just deferring. It's a deduction. It's a deference, and it's a permanent reduction in the amount payable because of the way it's structured in terms of more capital gains tax is a discount of 50% for starters. So,
yeah, and he's dead right on that. You know, it's ridiculous that they try and hold up their end of the bargain. But,
yeah. And he's showing a little bit of a social conscience here, Saul Eslake. He goes, yeah, it's funny how they keep saying the same and same things every time. I mean, when I hear people say that negatively geared investors are just mums and dads trying to get ahead, part of me wants to ask, ahead of whom are they trying to get ahead? And the answer is, when you examine it, their own children or their children's peers. it's true, unfortunately, when you think about it.
It is very true, yeah. Yeah. Mm.
So,
you know, it's yeah.
Yeah. So, dear listener, if you are sort of sitting on the fence on negative gearing, have a look at that link and listen to Saul Eslake and listen to the guy from the IPA who's arguing in favour of negative gearing. And honestly, at the end of it, if you can still come out in favour of negative gearing, I just wonder why. But are you enjoying the show and would you like to help out? There's a few easy things you can do. You can like us on Facebook, and you can go into iTunes and leave a positive review. That would be much appreciated. Also, if you're really keen, you could donate to us via Patreon. For details on how to do all this, visit our website. Thanks for your support. And now, back to the podcast. Scott, on another thing we could spend money on, came across listening to a podcast by Philip Adams, and real problem in the legal aid world at the moment. So, dear listener, in a previous life, I was a solicitor, and we did do, well, we had a criminal law practice, so we consequently had a lot of legal aid clients. And the legal aid, the way where money comes from legal aid, when people deposit money with solicitors in their trust account, so say from deceased estates or money that you're just holding for people because for different reasons, it gets invested, and the interest that accrues from those investments goes to legal aid, doesn't go to the solicitors or the client. So that's how legal aid has got a lot of its funding over the years. And of course, with interest rates at all-time lows, there's hardly any money coming from that side of things to fund legal aid. And so it's in dire straits. And Scott, there was a Productivity Commission recommendation that legal aid get $200 million injected. And the Productivity Commission found that we would provide a net economic benefit over the long term. And I reckon that could easily be the case. So stay tuned for a mere $200 million, Scott. You know,
a mere $200 million, it's less than, it's less than 10% of a sub. Really.
it's barely a periscope, Scott.
It's barely a periscope. Yeah, you're right, because you can get $4.5 billion a sub. So, yeah, it's a lot of money.
Mm.
So, it's not a hell of a lot of cash, and it's... Mm. I find it maddening that they haven't found $200 million just to plug this gap.
Yes. Well...
You know, it's not a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah. It's not an attractive buy for a lot of people, though, because they're thinking, oh, well, this is just going to drug addicts who are
You know better than this than I do, but it seems to me that if you've got no money...
Mm.
And you've got no money then in the legal aid system, that what you end up with is people representing themselves.
Yep.
And that's not good for anyone. It's not good for the courts.
No.
And it's not good for the individuals who's representing themselves.
Well, you know, you've got judges on $400,000 a year and lawyers on good money as well, and the time taken to get things done is tripled or quadrupled when you're dealing with self-represented people on one side. So as a system, it just clogs things up and nothing gets done easily or quickly. So I can well imagine the Productivity Commission saying, spend a little bit of money to give these people representation, and we've got a legal system that will be far more efficient as a result. I'm all for that. But I've got a particular interest, but hey... One of the benefits of being the candidate for the secular party, Scott, you can have a few special interests that you can look after, maybe. So
yeah, but you know, even if you say we spend 10% of a sub,
yeah,
you could then afford to put in $400 million into the system.
You could,
which is more than twice what the Productivity Commission recommends.
I mean, we sound silly, don't we? I mean, talking about these numbers, but the whole truth of it is that this Scott Morrison in this budget has just thrown money around so willy-nilly that it's just lying in puddles on the floor for us to pick up, Scott, if we want to just knock back some of these stupid ideas. Like, it's
that $50 billion over 10 years. That is criminal.
Yeah.
That anyone would think that was a good idea.
Yeah.
You know, it's madness.
So yeah. So we might sound flippant, dear listener, about the money, but you know, the quick back of the envelope calculations and the crazy way they've spent the money means that we can throw $200 million at a legal aid system and not even blink. Such are the rivers of gold that that Scott Morrison has left for us to play with. So, Scott, same-sex marriage makes good business sense, apparently.
It does make good business sense, yes. Mm. This is from The Conversation.
Mm.
I found this yesterday, I believe it was, or maybe the day before. Anyway, it goes through the whole thing... It basically comes down to avoiding boycotts, which is been the experience of those states in the United States that have introduced anti-same-sex marriage laws.
Mm.
Now, the United States Supreme Court has made a statement that marriage rights are universal and that they are for everyone inside the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But what you've got is a series of states that have gone not necessarily against the ruling of the Supreme Court, but they've gone against the character of the ruling.
Mm.
So you've got Mississippi recently passed a far-reaching law that enabled organizations to refuse services based on religious convictions, resulting in significant backlash from the business community. North Carolina faced boycotts in April 2016 after passing religious freedom law that included bathroom use and provisions. Republican presidential frontrunner Donald Trump later highlighted, "The problem with what happened in North Carolina is the strife and the economic punishment that they're taking." Now, why that becomes important is that you end up having a series of boycotts of those states.
Mm.
Now, supporting same-sex marriage helps businesses to avoid the discrimination implicit. Blah, 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 where is it? Yeah, they went through and they listed. Here we go. Companies in the US have reacted strongly to anti-same-sex marriage laws. After Indiana moved against it in 2015, Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff said the laws would discourage the company from spending in Indiana. Salesforce has reportedly helped employees uncomfortable with the laws move out of Indiana.
Mm.
Yelp CEO Jeremy Stoppelman advised states to reconsider such laws. He highlighted an unwillingness to operate in Indiana. So, you know, that's where it's coming from. Now, what it comes down to in Australia is that, you know, the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras in Sydney generates, $30 million, I think it was.
Just, what's that in terms of a sub?
Yeah. Yeah, it's probably about a Periscope. generates about $30 million in revenue. Now, over time, it's plausible that denying same-sex marriage would result in tourism-related economic benefits.
Mm.
So you've got you've got tourism that's going to be impacted if you don't have same-sex relationships, if you don't have same-sex marriage.
Yep.
International market for labour. Denying same-sex marriage could lead to difficulties attracting international talent in the long term.
Yep.
Australia's current position has not adversely affected employment. However, a persistent failure to legalise same-sex marriage is equivalent to rejecting it.
Mm.
Now, as we know, we're headed towards a plebiscite. And if the polling is to be believed, then we've got 60 or 70% of the population backing it anyway.
Mm.
So it's not going to be something that's not going to happen. But it is crazy that our government has decided to go down that way rather than simply just legislating for it in the parliament.
Yeah. So no, it's it just makes the point that states in America where they are regressive in these areas are actually losing business to other states, and potentially Australia, if it was to remain regressive, could lose business to other developed countries as well. But hopefully it won't come to that, Scott. I reckon we'll get there eventually. Well,
you're convinced that Bill Shorten's going to win, so it'll be legislated within the first 100 days.
That's right, yep. And, yeah. You know, I'll be sitting there in the Senate with you, Scott, beside me. Enjoying the leather of the Senate seats, and together we will pass that motion for that bill. So that'll be a fun moment for us.
It will be, yes.
Another article, basically referring to New Zealand, and
yes, this was very interesting, wasn't it?
I had a situation as well of religious instruction classes in New Zealand, and Somebody eventually got hold, through sort of freedom of information processes, some internal advice that the New Zealand Education Department had, basically saying that the religious instruction classes could well be in breach of the Human Rights Act. And so I don't know exactly the terms of their religious instruction classes and the Human Rights Act, but that's an interesting development in New Zealand where that could potentially strike out religious instruction based on a kind of a Bill of Rights sort of thing, Scott. And as much as I would love to see religious instruction out of Queensland and other states, let's do it properly.
You don't want to see it done with a Bill of Rights.
Exactly. Exactly. Because you know what? 5 years later, it could be reintroduced by virtue of the same Bill of Rights. That's why, Scott. Yeah. Like, another reading of the Bill of Rights in another way by an activist judge who's sympathetic to religion could actually then bring it back in under the same Bill of Rights. So let's just pass a normal act to get rid of it, I say.
Well, I don't think anyone disagrees with you on that.
Scott, let me see. National Secular Society in Great Britain had made some comments about stuff. So there was a fellow head of the Equality and Human Rights Commission said that the UK needed a more muscular approach to integration. It wasn't just going to happen by itself. And the National Secular Society said, well, that's all very well, but our system of state-sponsored faith schools is a significant and growing part of the problem and runs the obvious risk of worsening social fragmentation. It's all very well to say there should be a duty to integrate, but it's not clear how a system designed to segregate children by religion can be plastered over with a new duty handed down by the government. Rather than paying lip service to cohesion and diversity, what's really needed is a complete reappraisal of the whole concept of faith schools and a move towards inclusive secular schooling for all. And Scott, he could be talking about Australia, for that matter.
He could well be talking about Australia, yeah, for sure.
And I saw in today's news, there was talk about Peter Dutton had said how expensive it is to integrate immigrants into our country. And Julie Bishop said the same thing. And I wasn't yelling at the radio news when I heard it, but I was saying, well, you know, if you're wanting to integrate immigrants, you know, having faith schools where people can, you know, run separate parallel lives isn't going to help. So,
no, it's not. And you're going to end up with a ridiculous situation. You've got kids that are only learning to speak Arabic because they're speaking Arabic at home. The faith-based schools are largely conducted in Arabic. And you're going to end up with a ridiculous situation that kids are going to come out of the school not being completely fluent in English.
Scott, we are, I think, well over time, and we've had a few technical issues, dear listener, where our recording devices, both Scott and mine, have played up tonight, so we've sort of stopped and started in the background there, and hopefully I've managed to edit out all of our mistakes. So, last article, no prizes for guessing, my favourite topic, submarines.
You know, it wasn't all that long ago that you said it couldn't be a podcast without mentioning the Australian Christian lobby. Now it's not a podcast if we don't mention submarines.
I think so, yeah. It's a real hobby horse. But anyway, this article by Tony Wright, National Affairs Editor of The Age, and he says that consider this week's gigantic public expenditure decision, $50 billion to build 12 new submarines. A modern lightning-fast train on new tracks from Melbourne to Sydney would leave you around $10 billion change from that. Can you believe that, Scott? You could build a very fast train network from Melbourne to Sydney and have $10 billion change. Scott, that's just from the purchase price of the subs, let alone the ongoing maintenance. So what he makes the point here is that submarines can be extremely defective, effective, provided that you can't detect them. So while they're hidden and they can't be found, they're extremely effective. But as soon as something happens where you can spot them, then they suddenly, you know, they're useless to you, basically, because they can then be attacked. And what he's pointed to is that, yes, there are now these drones that will enter the ocean and swim around, and they'll be able to send out signals. And as computing power increases, they'll be able to analyze, you know, more and more data, and that ability to crunch the numbers on the data will allow them to detect subs. And so he's saying it's a very real risk that by the time these things are built, the detection advances will be such that you know, major powers will be able to find the subs, and they'll be absolutely useless to us, Scott. Like, just just tin drums out in the water for us. So I think that's enough about subs. I think that's enough about episode 45. You've got something else?
I think so, but before we just got to go, I just like this final paragraph. Australia has become a place where leaders happily allocate $50 billion for 12 submarines. They may have no useful future. $24 billion on joint strike fighters that are years overdue and remain beset by problems. $9 billion on three Hobart-class destroyers that are now 3 years over schedule, and $1 billion over budget, and $1 billion a year on to keep asylum seekers on distant islands. So I think that sums it up there for all the listeners out there.
So, Scott, yes, dear listener, we have struggled with technical issues, but hopefully we'll sort those out. And maybe, Scott, the same people who... Did we mention at the beginning about our website?
Yeah, we did,
So the website's under attack. Maybe the Russians or somebody have also managed to attack our respective little computers here. But anyway, next week, dear listener, we'll hopefully have that under control. Please, if you do not already, go onto our Facebook page and follow us on Facebook, because we're going to be crunching out announcements over the next week. And so keep an eye on that. And if you see something, like, we'll be posting lots of stuff, if you could share it, not just like it, but actually share it, so that it gets out there more and more. Because, Scott, I was talking... Well, people are wondering about the hustings and getting out there. And I was talking to Craig, who did electioneering last time for the Secular Party. And I said, so, you know, you're out there on the street and you're handing out flyers and people are coming past and, you know, collecting from you. I said, you know, how many sort of conversations do you strike up with people? And did he say about 1 an hour, something like that, if you're lucky? Or
if you're lucky, yeah.
So, dear listener, while we will be out on the hustings, you can help us be extremely effective with our messaging through Facebook and stuff. So go onto the website for both the Iron Fist Velvet Glove and the Secular Party, and when you see something that I've posted or Karen's posted, share it and like it, and that way we can sort of get it out there in front of people. So one I posted today, Scott, which was about spending money on chaplains and how much goes to Scripture Union and how much goes to chaplains. So last time I looked, that had reached over 4,000 people. So,
is that right?
So dear listener, if there's something like that and you like and share it, we can get to way more people and influence more people and get them to know about the Secular Party than hours and hours standing on a street corner handing out a flyer. So so please help with that and help us sort of get that message out there. So,
well, the what you're referring to, the government pays $50 per hour for school chaplains. $16 goes to the chaplain, $34 goes to Scripture Union management fees, has now reached 5,312 people.
There you go. So, it's got a little Secular Party logo on the bottom of it, and So, dear listener, that's the sort of thing. Go right now onto Facebook, Iron Fist Velvet Glove. Find that, share it, like it, and that will help us out a lot. And keep doing that all week if you can. Scott, I think the music's probably playing in the background.
Music's probably playing in the background, so thank you very much. I won't be here next week. You'll have Paul instead.
Okay, very good. So, yes. All right, well, we'll talk to you in 2 weeks, Scott, and otherwise, everyone else, I'll speak to you next week. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye now.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf, on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.